Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. There are more than 4.2 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the world now. Russia has moved into the number two spot for infections behind the United States, though the UK is reporting the second highest number of deaths. And again, that is behind the US. The global struggle against the coronavirus comes in the midst of a struggle for human rights. COVID-19, though, hasn't stopped the work of people like Dr. Keith Wattenpah. He is a professor and director of human rights studies at UC Davis, and he's joining us by phone from Davis. Dr. Wattenpah, thanks for your time today on Insight.
Good morning, Beth, and thank you for having me today.
I think you just heard the Johns Hopkins scholar talk about how the lack of a vaccine, when it's developed in pockets of displaced people, will actually continue to threaten everyone. Of course, those communities, but the rest of the world as well. This is vitally important, but I don't see a lot of news now about those displaced pockets of people.
Right, and that's one of our overriding concerns in contemporary human rights studies, is that those populations who are already at the margin, refugees, migrants, people well below the poverty line, people in war zones. Already these were easily dismissed people, and now in a time of global crisis, they're more easily forgotten as nations and people struggle with their own issues. But as Dr. Apaja said, the whole world needs to be vaccinated. The world, humanity itself, needs to be seen as a total in this moment, and not just nations acting on their own behalf.
The president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee said in an article recently in The New Yorker, the people that we're helping in war zones and refugee-hosting states in the world are living with some of the weakest health systems and some of the most dangerous public health conditions. And he went on, Keith, to say, there are 13 ventilators in the whole of Sierra Leone, for example, for 7.5 million people. 4 ventilators in all of South Sudan. And he makes the point that there is no reliance on a health system. So what happens when a vaccine is developed? How is that distributed?
That's the real question. And as I was listening to him, and he was talking about how it was a public health concern to vaccinate as many as we possibly can, it's also a human rights issue. You know, we have, as human beings, the right to health. And ensuring that the access to that health care is available to all really should be one of our overriding concerns. I mean, this is a crisis that was caused to no small extent by a failure of both nations and the international community to really take seriously global threats to our basic human right to health. And that's why this has moved from not just a health crisis to an economic crisis, but to paraphrase Antonio Guterres, the United Nations General Secretary, it is a global human rights crisis.
2 weeks ago, you helped organize a virtual conversation that included a number of groups, the UC Davis Global Affairs and International House, and the title of it was COVID-19 and the Disappearing International. That conversation was really popular on the day you hosted it, and it's continued to be circulated with a lot of attention. Will you tell me what the focus became and where people are really alert and concerned right now?
So that was a conversation that was hosted by Human Rights Studies at UC Davis, as well as the Davis Humanities Institute. And we're trying to continue our efforts to bring critical issues to our students and our university community and to the public at large. And we've begun experimenting with hosting online conferences and symposia and talks. And that conference, or that conversation, brought together 3 UC Davis experts on human rights, on international affairs, on the role of culture and society, law, my colleague at the law school, Karima Ben-Noun, and our vice provost for global affairs, Joanna Rogulska, to not just think about the immediate threat to human life and the right to be alive that the virus presents, but also think about some of the long-term impacts on everything from, in Joanna's case, the effects on the role of the university in trying to expose our students to the world, to share knowledge about how the world operates so our students can be true global citizens, to Professor Bannoun's concerns about the terrible impact that the virus is having, not just on artists and musicians who are being killed by it, but also on the global arts and humanities infrastructure, to my concerns about how already authoritarian or authoritarian leading regimes in Eastern Europe, Southeast Asia, and Africa are using the excuse of the virus to crack down on dissent and to sort of aggressively de-democratize. I think this is the case especially in Hungary and Uganda and Cambodia. So again, our other point, and I think this was a very important point to make, was that the arts and humanities, and this is why we collaborated with our friends in the Davis Humanities Institute, the arts and humanities have this incredibly important role in helping us get through this moment from, you know, having television shows to stream on Netflix, to watching past productions of wonderful plays from the National Theater in Britain, but also the ability for us to recognize and continue to recognize the humanity in one another while we're being asked to, in some cases, be inconvenienced, but in other cases, to make terrible sacrifices on behalf of others.
Well, with that, I'm going to go back to one more point that this IRC president made, and that is that the most important health response isn't a health facility, you know, isn't a building or maybe even medicine. His point is that it's trust. It's what happens between people and the involvement of the locals and the willingness to be part of the solution and the protection for the vulnerable community. And I think about how limited global travel is right now, Keith, and that puts even more onus on locals to do everything they can to become aware and educated and be safe.
That is correct. But I think what we're also seeing right now, and this is something that gives me room for optimism, you know, not hope, but optimism, which is that we are witnessing incredible social solidarity. And historically, when peoples and communities and nations have gone through these kinds of crises, they often emerge on the other side, societies more committed to human rights, societies more committed to equality. And that's societies that are more committed to recognizing the human in each other, because we've all are facing this terrible vulnerability, sharing it in this moment. And so this is an area where if we can rebuild trust in institutions, trust in healthcare, I actually think that we have a great deal of trust in our scientists and healthcare organizations, and an erosion of trust with some of our national leadership, which is a problem. But if we can, this I think is one of the key areas where we can draw some lessons that from the past that point to how, if we can continue to focus on working together, on recognizing the rights of others, that the kind of society that we might be able to emerge into when this is over, and it's from your speakers and so on, it's sounding like the ability or the availability of vaccines are many, many months in the future, that we'll be called upon again and again to really strive to maintain the dignity of all and to protect others in this crisis.
I appreciate your perspective. I'm so glad you could join us today in light of the conversation that we're having. And I wish you and your family well and your students. And I'm so glad that classes have been able to continue. What an experience.
It's been a learning experience for all of us. And the dedication of my colleagues at UC Davis has really been making this happen. I mean, I work on behalf of trying to defend the right to higher education for refugees around the world. And at this moment, we're working to defend the right of our own young people to continue to develop as human beings through scholarship and education so that they can take the leadership roles that they need to take in our society. But I miss the classroom, and I miss the seminars, and I miss sitting with my students drinking coffee and talking about the events of the day. But we'll get back to that. and I think that we'll be stronger and more committed to defending the rights of others when we do so.
Yeah, and how much we'll appreciate it when we can all do it again. Thank you so much, Dr. Wattenpah.
Thank you, Beth, for having us today.
Take care. Take care of your family. That is
okay.
Dr. Keith Wattenpah, the UC Davis Director of Human Rights Studies. We have another Keith joining us now for a completely different story. You might know that two men have been arrested and charged. It happened late last week. This is in relation to the murder in the shooting in Georgia back in January of a 25-year-old African-American man, Ahmaud Arbery. So Keith Lowell Jensen, a Sacramento comedian, wrote a tweet that in the days since has been retweeted and commented on by thousands of people. It was actually, if you were listening this morning, it was highlighted in a story on NPR, and Keith is joining us now. Thanks for making time for us today on a topic totally different from what you're usually joining us for, Keith.
Yeah, I have lots of time. Thanks for having me.
You are a very news-minded person. I assume you had been following the story since the shooting happened in January?
I wish I could say that I had. I must guiltily admit that I had not. And when the film came out, a lot of friends of mine, mostly friends of mine who are Black, were posting saying, "Hey, white America, you're a bit quiet on this." And I realized that it hadn't crossed my radar. And that seemed like a problem. And so for myself, I wanted to do my part to shine more light on it, and then to also kind of get ahead of the game and look at cases like Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, which is another case that hadn't crossed my radar, where she was shot 8 times by cops that barged into her apartment looking for someone that had already been apprehended elsewhere.
So just to fill in a little bit on the Arbery case, the shooting had happened, time passed, there was a lot of speculation, and then a video was shared, and that's what changed things in this last week. It is actually the point that happened last Tuesday. Before then, Thursday, the arrest and the charging came. So you're talking about that video in which Mr. Arbery is seen running toward a truck. He gets involved in a struggle with a man that's holding a shotgun. They move sort of in and out of the frame, and then he falls to the ground. And I do want to get to what you wrote about as you watched the situation, saw the video, and then saw the arrest. So if you would give me some context and then read your tweet, Keith, I'd appreciate it.
I'm having trouble dealing with the fact that we've gotten to a place in society where we so regularly see snuff films. A lot of debate on whether or not we should be sharing them. And in a case like this, I think it did make a difference. You know, when I was a kid and there was footage like that, they didn't show it on the news.
Right.
But now we handle that ourselves with Twitter and with Facebook and Instagram. And so we do see it. And how many people have we seen get killed now? And it's very painful and difficult to look at. But then to look at that and know that other people had already been seeing this for months, then the rest of us see it. And the arrests happen almost immediately afterwards, once there's that public pressure. And I've had pushback from some people that say that the arrests were coming anyway. I'm sorry, it doesn't take that many months when it's a Black person holding the gun and a white person on the ground.
And so you wrote a tweet that said...
got to quote it exactly now, don't I?
Do you want me to read it?
No, I got it here. I said, always remember, they didn't make the arrests when they saw the tape. They made the arrests when we saw the tape. And it was just a quick thing that I dashed off as that occurred to me. And it took off and blew up, and all of a sudden I had thousands of people retweeting it, and then people yelling at me, and then other people claiming credit for it. In the case of one of my jokes that happens and I fight, in the case of this, I was like, I don't care. My name's not the important one here. You know, it's a very strange thing as a comedian to get a bunch of attention for, because really I'd rather the attention went to Ahmaud Arbery. If names are going to be said, I hope they would be Breonna Taylor's name and Sandra Bland's name and Tamir Rice's name, Freddie Gray, Oscar Grant, Lando Castile. I mean, we could keep going. So I'm glad that I was able to put words to something that a lot of people were feeling in a way that I guess was efficient and did the job. It's also a very strange way to have attention focused on you when you're used to being a comedian. People being like, hey, cool, you said a funny thing, made me laugh, brought me joy.
Mm-hmm. So just for you, tell me a bit more about the distinction in writing. They didn't make the arrest because they saw the tape. They made the arrest because we saw the tape. And I think what so many people are grabbing onto is what that we means. And Keith Wattenpah, before you, talked about social solidarity. So what is the we to you right now in this time?
We the people. You know, we saw it and we got upset and we got angry. And then they saw that they weren't going to be able to sweep it under the rug. It became too public, became too widely known of a case. How many other cases are happening right now, though, where there's not some tape that's going to come out that's going to focus that kind of attention on them, and so they're going to continue to be able to not press charges and ignore it, you know? And I think it's important that we remember that. That it wasn't until we saw the tape, that we saw the evidence, that they did something about it. It wasn't because of the evidence. It was because of our response to the evidence and our demand. So I think we both need to remember that, A, it's important for us to take that action and to raise our voices, but also to remember that there are other cases where we don't have a tape. We don't have something that's going to go viral. That's why I want to keep saying Breonna Taylor's name, because that's one of those cases. And it's not getting this kind of attention, but it's equally horrifying and terrible.
Ordinarily, I might end a conversation, Keith, with promoting the next show or a comedy album you've just released.
Yeah, I thought about that in advance, and I don't want to.
No, I'm going to post a link for everybody to find that. Your Twitter handle is at Keith Lowell, L-O-W-E-L-L. And I want to thank you for the conversation and for the discussion that you've raised for all of us. I really appreciate you joining us today, Keith.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
And take care. Well wishes. Sacramento comedian Keith Lowell Jensen. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio.